Thank you guys so much for coming today. It's a real honor to be here. I have so many people I want to thank. First of all, Dean Cepeda Benito for a lovely introduction. And I really appreciate your support of this award. My mentor and friend and brother and neighbor in Old Mill is Lukola Sambe, who has been a dear friend and supporter since I came here 13 years ago. He's a model as a scholar and as a teacher and as a human being. Dale Osef is a treasure of mine and one of those rare students that makes you remember why you got into this game to begin with. I want to thank Val Roy and Major Jackson for all of their enormous support. And I want to thank my students, present and past, who came today. I know you have a lot to do, so it really is meaningful to me that you turned up. And last but not least, I want to thank my husband, John Gennari, who I don't think is here yet. Oh, he is here? Oh, he's okay. All right. And our daughters, who I think he's probably doing the trade-off, who who inspired this talk and inspire me to keep trying. So my talk today my talk today is called Becoming Black, a meditation on racialization. And this talk, I want to warn you, is not written in the vein of traditional academic scholarship. It's more of a personal essay. And like most essays in that genre that have inspired me, it's full more of questions than answers. And so I invite you on this journey to contemplate, to consider the questions that have been really inspiring to me. The essay is a kind of attempt to carve out some space to wrestle with the knotty issue of race, as I think it impacts all of our lives. And I almost forgot to say that I'm very privileged today to have Carla Kaplan in the audience, who is a former professor of mine and current soul sister, intellectual soul sister, as I describe you often, and she's giving her talk tomorrow afternoon. So the talk, as I said, is called Becoming Black, and I'm going to tell it in fragments and several parts. Black history. 2 years ago, when they were 6 years old, my daughters, Julia and Isabella, were watching television during Black History Month. A commercial came on. It was more like one of those 30-second history lessons, a commemoration of a pilot, a poet, or a politician, a first black, as a professor of mine used to call them, them being the racial pioneers, the inaugural Negroes, the foremost African Americans to break through racial barriers in their chosen fields. And by breakthrough, I mean, of course, to secure the acceptance of white people. "See, we're black," Julia said to Isabella. "No, we're brown," Isabella responded. "Yeah, but they call it black," Julia explained. My heart sank a bit. Despite my efforts to shield them, my daughters had somehow gotten wise to the absurd and illogical nature of American racial identity. Blackness, Julia had figured out, had nothing to do with actual skin color. Blackness, she had somehow come to understand, was an external identity, external to her, something other people identified, something they said, but not necessarily saw. A social category, not a color, but a condition. And like it or not, it was time, she was letting her sister know, to get with the proverbial program. In spite of me, but also maybe because of me, my brown daughters were becoming black. As it often goes with things like this, things between parents and children, and maybe between mothers and daughters in particular, my sinking heart had more to do with me than with them. My early lessons in blackness were tutorials in trauma. I was born in Nashville, Tennessee during the Civil Rights era. In my family, race was not a construction. It was not a theory or an outdated consequence of history, but the active, living foundation of our reality. Race determined the contours of every choice we made, where we attended church, where my father practiced medicine, and where we lived. Every mundane public act we performed was a project that had a name. When we moved into our house, it was called integration. When my brothers and I entered the public school system, it was called desegregation. The split between black and white was not metaphorical. Railroad tracks divided black and white Nashville. On the white side of town, we played a role in a grand project of enormous proportion. On the black side, we lived our lives. The grand project was history. That was what we were making, I was reminded on a regular basis. There was a cost to the project. We lived on the white side of town. Once we woke to find a for sale sign in the yard directing us in impolite language to go home. Our house was less a home than an island in hostile waters. Early on, I learned that being black meant that you had to be constantly aware, that you could never really be at ease. Being black in a white place meant that you had to accept the fact that the world was not a safe place, not for you. On the other side of the railroad tracks, we lived a different kind of blackness. That's where my father practiced medicine, where we attended events at Fisk University, one of the country's oldest historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, and my parents' alma mater. It was where we went to church in a small chapel designed for the faculty and students of Meharry Medical College, from which both of my parents graduated. Among the parishioners were men and women I called aunt and uncle, even though we had no biological relationship. We shared something bigger and more profound than blood, perhaps, and that was history. Inside the church, we celebrated our belief in God and a common pride in how we all made it over. We were a community, built in spite of and because of American racism. Because if it had not been for white supremacy, schools like Fisk and Meharry might never have existed. But my daughters were not born under the shadow of this history. They are black by law, but not by blood. They may be black now, but they didn't start that way. They were born in Ethiopia. When they were 12 months old, they assumed dual citizenship in both America and African America. Now they live in South Burlington, Vermont. Inside the small city is their neighborhood, which is curiously more integrated than the neighborhood I grew up in, even today. Inside the neighborhood is a family where the native language is color, not race. We were out of town visiting friends, a white couple, and I told them the Black History Month story. I could tell that they were unsettled. I tried to explain why I wanted to protect my daughters from the language of race, but my explanations only seemed to make them impatient. "Don't you want them to know their history?" one of them asked. I knew what she meant. She meant the civil rights movement, Martin, Malcolm, other first blacks, February stories, which, as American stories, belong to them as much as they belong to my daughters. My daughters do know their history. We flipped through picture books of 12th century Ethiopian underground churches carved out of rock. I show them websites that feature both modern photographs and centuries-old drawings of Ethiopian kings and queens. "Yours is the only African country to fight off the colonizer," I remind them often. Every mother thinks her daughter looks like an angel, but my daughters really do resemble the doe-eyed, haloed brown cherubs that dominate Ethiopian Orthodox Christian iconography. "Why did white people make black people slaves?" Isabella asked one February afternoon. "There's slavery all over the world," I told her, "even in Ethiopia." I am both proud and envious that my daughters were born in a world where not only slaves, but also angels and aristocrats look just like them. In the world in which I grew up, Jesus was blonde and blue-eyed. I almost got into a fight in high school when I informed a white classmate, that Jesus probably had brown skin and definitely had hair like lamb's wool. He was just as baffled as he was enraged. He was as blonde and blue-eyed as, well, Jesus, or Megyn Kelly, the Fox News host who told her viewers in December that Jesus was as white as Santa Claus. How could information like that not shake him to the core? As I said, I admired my daughter's history and envy it too, as have African Americans since the time when we were Negroes. "To know where the Negro is going, one must know where the Negro comes from," wrote Trinidadian writer and activist C.L.R. James in his 1939 essay, The Destiny of the Negro. He castigates capitalist pseudoscientists for attempting to, quote, "deprive the Negro of any share in the famous civilizations of Egypt and Ethiopia." Before him, W.E.B. Du Bois composed The Star of Ethiopia, an American historical pageant which opened in New York in 1913. The play, which in one of its productions used almost 1,000 actors, outlined the history of African Americans throughout time. Du Bois described the drama. He wrote, "It begins with the prehistoric black men who gave the world the gift of welding iron. Ethiopia, mother of men, then leads the mystic procession of historic events past the glory of ancient Egypt, the splendid kingdoms of the Sudan and Zimbabwe, down to the tragedy of the American slave trade. Up from slavery slowly, the black race writhes back to life and hope, on which the star of Ethiopia gleams forever." My daughter's connection to Africa does not have to be fashioned or dramatized, invented or recuperated. It is a concrete reality that many African Americans aspire to. That aspiration is represented in the term African American itself. So much of the complexity of being African American inheres in the fact that we are, in fact, African Americans, products of this soil, yet rooted in something somewhere else. Becoming American. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. This is W.E.B. Du Bois in his 1903 classic, The Souls of Black Folk. When I was growing up, some of my West Indian cousins found the unreconciled strivings of African Americans tiresome and confusing. Educated in the States at HBCUs, they exasperated their classmates by insisting that black alienation was self-imposed. "Why can't black people embrace a national identity?" my cousin Anita asked. She claimed she couldn't understand it. I was not surprised when she returned to Trinidad after college. During a trip I made to the island with my family as a teenager, a couple of years after Anita had left the States for good, I tried to get her to identify one of her friends using the clumsy, ill-fitting American racial terminology that she had come to detest because it was the only terminology I had. "He's Trinidadian," she said. The conversation ended as abruptly as did her relationship to America. What had been promoted by her elders, including my father, as a land of professional opportunity, proved to her to be an intolerable ideological straitjacket. My father was different. Unlike his nieces and nephews, he embraced blackness, threw himself into it, in fact, with a kind of romantic fervor. He landed on these shores from Trinidad at the dawn of the Civil Rights Movement, and his passion for blackness intensified with the rise of the Black Power Movement. Black, he remembered, was a term coined by Black Power activist Stokely Carmichael, who was my father's contemporary in age and a fellow Trinidadian. As I was interviewing my father for this talk, I could imagine my mother's voice wryly reminding me in the background of Stokely Carmichael's famous line when he was asked about the ideal position of women in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He said, "Prone." Anyway, hopefully it's an apocryphal story. As my father reminisced, I considered the parallels between him and Carmichael. Both graduates of HBCUs, Carmichael went to Howard. Both christened with undeniably British names. My father's first and middle names are Harold Oswald. And both as children subjects of the crown. Stokely Carmichael would change his name to Kwame Ture. Did the outside change the inside? My father took to blackness, but Americanness not so much. I remember joking around once at the dinner table with my brothers and my father staring at us as if we were from outer space. "Where did I get these American children?" he wondered aloud. For my father, blackness was in here, organic and natural, but Americanness was a consequence of chance and timing. He might have wound up in England if it hadn't been for his uncle, another graduate of Meharry, who offered him America, where he wound up with children who would not only grow up on the other side of what appeared to him, at least that night at the dinner table, as an unbridgeable, ineffable divide, but would also continually frustrate him by mispronouncing words like advertisement. Valentine. February is a tricky month for brown girls, at least in our house. In the fall of her kindergarten year, Isabella found herself in the middle of a romance. Excuse me. It wasn't that she had fallen in love. Love had fallen on her. The boy who tumbled is called Colin. He's an affable child, pale and blue-eyed, with pale eyelashes and a long, thin face. At their after-school program, he always seemed to be standing around sheepishly with his hands in his pockets. Except for the time I saw him stand behind Isabella and, unbeknownst to her, gather up her braids lightly and let them fall tenderly over and over again as if he were playing with a beaded curtain. In October, Colin invited Isabella to his birthday party. We had a conflicting engagement, so Isabella told him that she would be unable to go. Colin's mother called. He was beside himself, she said. He admired her. Was there something we could do? In lieu of the birthday party, she asked if Isabella could ride the bus home with Colin the next afternoon and play. When I went to pick up Isabella, Colin's mother and I chatted while the kids said goodbye. Isabella went to Colin and gave him one of her signature bear hugs. I saw his arms drop to his sides and a stunned, glassy look take over his face. I knew in that moment that Colin was in love. After the play date, Colin stepped up his game. He asked Isabella on a date. "What did you say?" I asked her. "Well, I told him I couldn't cut school," she told me. And then in early February, he told her he was going to draw a Valentine's card with a picture on the front of them kissing on the lips. He wrote her a note I found in her backpack. "Your hair is pretty," read the 5-year-old scrawl. He signed it with a drawing of a heart. But a week before Valentine's Day, Colin told Isabella that he was only going to give the light people Valentine's that year. He would give her a Valentine's the following year. I didn't hear about this until bedtime, when so many revelations come to light. My first and last instinct was that Colin had not meant the comment maliciously. She told me that what he said had hurt her feelings, so I emailed their teacher. It was important, I felt, that she know that racial difference had reared its head in her classroom in a potentially destructive way. The next day, the teacher arranged a sit down between Colin and Isabella. Colin offered an apology, Isabella accepted, and according to Isabella and her teacher, the two of them spent the rest of the day playing happily together. Having watched him, I felt I knew what had happened. I saw that Colin was aware of Isabella, that he looked at her a lot in a way that I don't think she looked at him. She was used to seeing white people. He was not used to seeing brown people. I believe he was trying to make sense of what it meant for him to care for a girl whose skin was so different from his. Years from now, I imagine he might be embarrassed at having made such a comment. I was reminded of a story that a friend from college told me many years ago. One of the first people that his Dutch grandfather met when he immigrated to the States was a black man. The two men shook hands, and my friend's grandfather looked down at his palm, thinking the man's color might have rubbed off onto his own hand. The best part of the story, my friend said, was that whenever his grandfather told this anecdote, he always said, "Somewhere right now, there is a black man telling a story to his family about that idiotic, fresh-off-the-boat Dutch guy he met many years ago who thought his color was temporary." And every time I'm reminded of that story, I think of the exchange that took place between Malcolm X and Alex Haley in a U.S. airport. Haley was admiring an arriving family of European immigrants. They are about to learn their first word in English, Malcolm X predicted, "nigger." A regrettable choice. I've heard it said that a rite of passage in every black parent's life is the moment when his or her child comes home and asks, "What does nigger mean?" I don't remember bringing the question to my parents, but I'm sure I must have, because I cannot remember a time in my childhood when I did not know what the word meant. For as long as I can remember, I knew that nigger meant to be different, to be outside, to be less. The first time I heard it directed at me, it had a cataclysmic effect, and it took me 20 years and a long essay to confront and dismantle the pain, rage, and shame brought on by that moment. The first time the girls heard the N-word, I was the one who said it to them. I had given a talk on my work on the white author and archivist Carl Van Vechten and his personal and professional involvement in the Harlem Renaissance at a book festival in Woodstock, Vermont. My daughters wanted to come, and John and I agreed on the condition that they sit quietly and pay attention. Not 5 minutes, you know how this went, right? Not 5 minutes into my talk, they had weaseled their way up to the podium and began tussling over who would control the pointer. Later, I accused Isabella of going back on our contract and not paying attention. I was paying play attention, she explained, playing and paying attention. Okay, then what was the talk about, I asked her. It was about a white man who made a regrettable choice in the title of his book, she said. Okay. Do you remember the title, I asked her? No, what was it? Forget it, it had a bad word in it, I said. Was it the F word? The H word? The S word? No, no, and no. I managed to distract her from the topic until later that evening when she introduced the mystery to Julia, who ran down the same list of consonants. Finally, I relented. The title was Nigger Heaven, I said. The word was nigger. What does it mean, they wanted to know. It's a bad word that white people sometimes use to put black people down, I said. They were quiet for a moment. Then Julia put her hand on her hip. Well, that's rude, she said. It was like a revelation. It is rude, I thought. And maybe that's all it will be for them. A few weeks later, Julia came home from spending time with a girl in the neighborhood, 11 years old and white. The girl had told her and her sister that you could get arrested for using the M word, Julia said. It's the N word, I said. It's the word we were talking about the other night. No, it's the M word, Mom, she said. Two lumps. That's hilarious. No. N has one lamp, two. Okay, no. Anyway, I've been dining out on that story for weeks. Okay, B words. Donna is the name of the girl's neighborhood friend. In the summer, she drops her bike in the front yard and thunders through our house in her bare feet looking for our daughters, or runs right up to the girl's room where they each insist that she piggyback them around the house. In the summer, the three of them tromp up and down the streets of our neighborhood, hopping from pool to pool, outfitted in slick, wet bathing suits and mismatched flip-flops. Outside of this frame, the race stories, as my seminar students and I call them, are dispiriting. But inside of the frame is a world I could never have imagined when I was growing up in Nashville. But the South of my childhood has changed too. Shortly after the historic 2008 presidential election, I took a trip to Nashville and saw a bumper sticker on the back of a pickup truck that read, "Rednecks for Obama." Working for the man who'll do more for the working man. This was 2008. There was a good old boy at the wheel and a gun rack in the back. Suddenly, my story about growing up in Nashville had a new chapter. My daughters will have their own stories, and the ones I've told here may or may not describe them or even interest them at all. In fact, while watching television with Julia last month, I asked her if she remembered the exchange she had had with her sister while they were watching television during Black History Month 2 years ago. She didn't. I prodded. You know, the thing you said about being black. I'm not black, she said. I'm brown, like you. I'm brown and black, I told her, realizing this truth for the first time. What I haven't described this afternoon is a sheer pleasure I take in blackness, the racial joy I experienced every time I heard my church aunts and uncles tell the tales, the black tales, about how they made it over. And by black, I mean black, not African American. I was born in the same era in which my father was reborn, in the wake of the civil rights movement and the first stirrings of black power, and all of those glorious struggles and triumphs in between. It goes deep, beyond the skin, that organic racial romance that informs everything I do and everything I write. I am black and brown too. Two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body. Actually, for me, they're in perfect symmetry. Brown is the body I was born into. Black are the stories that I tell. Thank you.